You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Full screen. At 20, YouTube has hosted billions of videos, launched stars, and made Hollywood nervous by Joy Press. Drive 5 miles north of the Hollywood sign, and you'll find yourself in Burbank, where they actually make the dreams for the Dream Factory. Casablanca, Reservoir Dogs, and Euphoria were all shot here. Today, tucked inside an unmarked warehouse in a particularly drab patch of the city, Rhett MacLachlan and Link Neal are filming their own contribution to entertainment history, a segment called Will It Dip, for their delightfully goofy and imaginative YouTube series, Good Mythical Morning. After taste testing a soupy dip made out of mashed Girl Scout cookies, the duo are presented with a bowl of black goo served under glass. MacLachlan removes the lid, and thick smoke fills the set, which is designed to look like a ramshackle fishing lodge. When the cameras stop rolling, Neil tells the show's culinary producer, "I do feel like you were trying to kill us a little bit." MacLachlan and Neil are friends from small-town North Carolina who met in first-grade detention. They experimented with making films as teens, and at 21, MacLachlan auditioned for The Real World, unsuccessfully. In 2006, the guys were shooting comic skits and songs after work in a basement when they realized that YouTube, still very much in its infancy, could be a great outlet for their stuff. These days, they operate out of this 17,000-square-foot maze, which comes complete with writers' rooms, test kitchens, and a prop department full of bizarro pieces from episodes past and future. The Mythical Company now makes multiple series and podcast, as well as having a food website, merchandising, and an investment fund for the next generation of digital creators. Their YouTube channels have a combined audience of 30 million subscribers. And Good Mythical Morning alone has twice as many viewers aged 18 to 34 as Seth, Stephen, Jimmy, and Jimmy combined. What more could MacLachlan and Neil want? Hollywood awards and a little of the prestige that comes with them for starters. Obviously, it's cool in L.A. when you've got a shelf with an Emmy on it, says MacLachlan, grinning through his thicket of facial hair. The awards are designed to recognize what is resonating culturally. Well, we are resonating culturally, so we should be a part of that conversation. Shows that get the awards, there's the sense that these are the real shows. We want to be on the same stage because we are competing with them directly. You want to be treated like a real boy, I say. Exactly, MacLachlan says, laughing. It's an expansion of what entertainment is, Neil adds. We're not trying to kill anything. We're just trying to be invited to the party. Speaking of parties, YouTube is celebrating its 20th birthday this year, and no one could blame it for feeling jubilant. The platform has overcome rampant underestimation and sporadic demonization to become the second most visited website in the world, behind its parent company, Google. 2.5 billion people watch YouTube videos every month. It has hosted 20 billion videos since launching in 2005, and its content has partially, or completely, replaced traditional television viewing for many of them. Smart TVs have made the site so easily accessible that television screens have now surpassed phones and laptops as the primary way people watch it in the U.S. Where a previous generation of families might have gathered around the electronic hearth to watch Survivor, they now communally binge Amelia Dimonsenberg's swoon-worthy chicken shop date, or Michelle Kerr's Daredevil docuseries Challenge Accepted. Care takes on intense challenges for her series, anything from training to be a chess grandmaster to earning a black belt in 90 days. When she premiered the latter 77-minute episode at the Montclair Film Festival last fall, multiple families approached her. It wasn't, "Hey, I'm here because my kids like you." It was, "We're here because when an episode of Challenge Accepted drops, we all sit down on Friday night to watch it together." All of which fuels Hollywood's long love-hate relationship with the platform. YouTube wants to be taken seriously in Hollywood, and they are being taken very seriously, says David R. Craig, a former TV executive turned USC professor and co-author of Social Media Entertainment, The New Intersection of Hollywood and Silicon Valley. Not so much as a creator of content, but as a distraction from the content that Hollywood produces. The anxiety has been hanging in the air for years. Back in 2020, Netflix co-founder Reed Hastings asked me rhetorically, "Does creative quality on YouTube just go up and up and up so that eventually it meets viewers' needs? Do we get out-competed by some combination of user-generated content?" He called platforms like YouTube and TikTok his streamer's biggest threat/opportunity. Netflix was also a tech company and relative newcomer at this point, one that had only started presenting original series in 2013. Remember House of Cards? Its own entry into what was soon dubbed the streaming wars sent the industry into convulsions. A kind of detente between Hollywood and YouTube emerged as executives realized how useful the platform was for distributing their own wares, whether clips from Saturday Night Live or blockbuster movie teasers. I speak with all the studio heads on a regular basis, and they recognize YouTube as one of their most important partners. YouTube CEO Neil Mohan tells me, "The studios are eager to create new business opportunities for their franchises and IP on YouTube, as well as reach their fandoms," he says. "And in the strictest sense, they aren't competitors, since YouTube doesn't actually produce any programming. It just provides a stage for creators to do their thing and shares the ad money with many of them." In an illustration by Maria Jesus Contrera, a flat-screen TV is shown with a laptop connected, and the people on screen are actually reaching out from the screen into the room. Still, entertainment execs quietly derided YouTube for much of its existence, seeing it as little more than a farm team providing poachable raw talent, including Justin Bieber, Broad City, Bo Burnham, Troy Sivan, Kyle Mooney, and Lily Singh. When longtime YouTuber Issa Rae started uploading episodes of her 2011 web series, The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl, a writer friend advised her to format it like a proper TV show. Invitations to adapt it for primetime soon followed, but as Rae later told the New York Times, they wanted to make it as broad as possible. She eventually made her way to HBO, where she co-created the award-winning Insecure. McLaughlin and Neil took a different path. Their YouTube channel led to a gig on a short-lived 2011 cable TV series called Commercial Kings. Instead of being their big break, it left them in L.A. limbo. They churned out scripts and took endless meetings. The vast majority of things that you put your time into, no one's ever going to see, because that's just how this town works, McLaughlin says. Both men had small children at home. They ultimately decided to double down on being YouTube creators, with all the freedom that entails. The ones who do it the best build a real community. And then it's not about, what can I sell them? It's, what can I create to expand my reach, says Oren Rosenbaum, a partner at United Talent Agency and co-head of their creators division. There's many examples of creators who started with us doing one thing and now have written a book, gone on tour, created a podcast, launched a consumer product. If you've built this loyal audience and you find a thing that makes sense for you and for them, it's a home run. And as USC's Craig points out, YouTube creators can do more than just make money off of their followers. They can also persuade them to vote in certain ways and care about certain causes. That includes a number of right-wing podcasters and conspiracy theorists who built Nest on YouTube. Streamers like Netflix and Peacock are eager to scoop up YouTube talent, who come with a built-in global audience. But when Hollywood comes knocking, successful creators increasingly consider it a side gig. Why give up total control over your project when no one knows as much about your viewers as you do? Superstar creator Mr. Beast, also known as Jimmy Donaldson, recently launched a reality competition called Beast Games for Amazon Prime. Although Amazon says it was their most watched unscripted series ever, it's unlikely Donaldson will forsake his digital kingdom. All of these creators tend to think about how to use what they're doing off-platform to drive viewers back to home base, says YouTube VP Tara Walpert-Levy. She was delighted to see a list of mantras on the wall of Mr. Beast's studio. At the top of the list, YouTube first. While YouTube toasts to 20 years of memes and memories, the traditional entertainment industry is in agonizing flux. On the more traditional side of things, it's all about cost-cutting, says Ali Berman, partner at UTA and co-head with Rosenbaum of the Creators Division. It's so ironic, because on our side of the business, it's all about increasing staff, creating writers' rooms, hiring producers. Our creators are building the media companies of today. Mohan, YouTube's CEO, likes to call the legion of creator-led studios popping up the startup economy of Hollywood. That goes for Burbank denizens, like the Mythical Morning Gang, as well as Alan Chikin Chow, a mastermind of candy-colored teen skits who recently opened a production hub there. But some of the new studios are nowhere near L.A. Kenigra Dion, a purveyor of family-friendly shorts and feature-length videos, is building a production hub in Alabama. Mr. Beast operates from a 50,000-square-foot studio in North Carolina, and Dude Perfect just unveiled an 80,000-square-foot space in Texas. Even further afield, the rural Indian town of Tulsi is known as YouTube Village because more than a quarter of the population is involved in creating videos, inspiring the local government to establish a state-of-the-art studio. Some of the bigger American creator studios combine amateurs and pros. When CARE needs to mount an epic production, like learning how to do Harry Houdini's most dangerous stunt, her team can balloon to 80 people on set. She thinks of her show in terms of seasons and arcs, which she hopes will make it easier for Hollywood to see the well-produced work she does as Emmy-worthy or even Oscar-adjacent. YouTube now offers its creators the ability to arrange their videos as distinct series with bingeable episodes, and YouTube Premium is rolling out the option to watch at 4x playback speed. The argument goes that if it looks like TV and acts like TV, surely it should be rewarded and awarded like TV. YouTube programs have won some Emmys, but only in ghettoized interactive media categories. Hot Ones and Good Mythical Morning made it onto Emmy ballots last year, but neither snagged nominations. Mohan is pushing for the TV Academy to be more welcoming. If you're trying to recognize creativity that comes out of the cultural zeitgeist, how can you exclude this enormous class of content? The Oscars and Emmys themselves, partly sprung out of fledgling industry's desire to drum up legitimacy, capital, and cultural respect. Craig suggests that YouTube has similar reasons for wanting to be included. In 1981, the head of the FCC referred to television as a toaster with pictures, he says. Those same kinds of condemnations are leveled at social media platforms. So YouTube has a very strong reason to want to gain more legitimacy from the greater society, so that they don't find themselves lumped in with other social media platforms being accused of destroying civilization. While traditional TV studios have humans vetting content and applying strict standards, however, YouTube is a largely unregulated environment ruled by algorithms. Trolling, scamming, racism, and sexually inappropriate material float through the ether. Think PewDiePie's anti-Semitic videos or Logan Paul's infamous footage of what appeared to be the body of someone who died by suicide. Tales of radicalization, like Caleb Cain's, are not uncommon either. Mohan points out that YouTube tries to strike a balance. It has community guidelines and often takes appropriate action, but it is first and foremost an open platform. Our mission is to give everyone a voice and show them the world, he says. There isn't a gatekeeper or a standards body exercising their judgment, and that's fundamentally the power of YouTube. Mythical's Neil acknowledges that YouTube was once a Wild West, but notes that as it's grown in influence, his peers have upped production values. The audience now is turning on their television, and they're seeing the YouTube icon right next to Max and Netflix. They don't want to see somebody leaning up against their bed with a handheld camera. The question of whether content is high quality enough to merit mainstream approbation strikes YouTube's levy as completely irrelevant. Viewers vote with their time what they perceive to be the most high quality, which sometimes aligns with how we traditionally in the industry would have defined and picked it, and sometimes doesn't, she says. I really believe that viewers have erased the distinction between different aspects of our entertainment ecosystem. This is just sort of new TV, and we're all in it together. The majority of YouTubers still don't aspire to win Emmys, and many of them make videos that don't fit into any of traditional TV's categories, which is part of the point. Where else would you find someone like Mina Lee, whose videos combine cultural commentary and personal adventures, or the performative music criticism of Anthony Fantano's The Needle Drop? Yet it makes perfect sense that entertainment industry insiders would resist embracing an atomizing platform that has no interest in upholding its strictures and standards. UTA's Rosenbaum is keeping his eye on the next generation of entertainment executives moving up the ladder. They're the ones that are consuming this content, he says, and now they're in the position where they can create change. McLaughlin says he's had a lot more industry people wondering if they should skip all the pitches and make work for YouTube. You meet someone who has had a lot of success, maybe as an actor or a producer, and they're like, man, I wish I could build something like you guys, he says, because they're at the whims of the studio. Not that the path McLaughlin and Neil took was an easy one. The partner spent a dozen years building an audience for Good Mythical Morning, not to mention all the videos they made before that. Yes, it's over here on YouTube, but it's an institution, McLaughlin says proudly, and it gets around. At a recent party, he met an actor who asked what he was working on. When McLaughlin mentioned his channel, the actor said, oh, I know Good Mythical Morning. My urologist showed me a video of you and your friend getting a vasectomy together. a dose of reality, the Emmys would be less, what's the word, boring, if they stopped snubbing The Grand Circus of Reality TV by John Ross. Opening illustration showing various stars of reality TV by Dewey Saunders. God bless Jean Smart, but I don't know if I can watch her win another Emmy. She's already collected 3 for her delicious work on Hacks. She's never been nominated for the series without winning, and this September, she will likely be called to the stage for her 4th. John Oliver's Last Week Tonight, meanwhile, has won 30 awards in 11 years, and I can recite from memory his perennial speech, thanking staff members in Brooklyn. Some 140 years ago, when Nietzsche advanced the concept of eternal return, he was talking about how boring the Emmys are. All this is not entirely the voters' fault. Television is built on multi-season series, but they'll clearly vote for the same people over and over until they get carpal tunnel. The result is that the industry's most respected awards show has been stagnant and zeitgeist adjacent a long time. Even as a teen, I remember watching Frasier win Best Comedy Series 5 years in a row and thinking, is that all there is? The Emmys need more electricity and drama, by which I mean they need reality stars. Yes, the Television Academy rewards reality TV, but mostly at the Creative Arts Emmys a week earlier, which has all the glitz and buzz of Air Force Two. The Primetime Emmys can start reinventing itself by adding 2 new categories to the broadcast. 1 for Best Performance in a Reality Program, and another for Best Performance in a Reality Competition. The former would bring stars like The Real Housewives of Potomac, Gisele Bryant, Salt Lake City housewife Mary Cosby, and Love is Blind's Hannah Giles into the drowsy theater. These are not women who are going to give polite speeches thanking their agents. These are women who know how to deliver. They will be a renewable resource of theatrics and priceless sound bites. Reality Competition, meanwhile, would recognize contestants from beloved series like Survivor, The Traitors, The Bachelor, and RuPaul's Drag Race. Contestants from Survivor can be weird, funny, savvy, and fiercely intelligent. Mike White was on the show long before he created The White Lotus and made brotherly incest a subplot of prestige TV. Reality series have given us charming, ruthless pop culture icons like Parvati Shallow and Boston Rob, not to mention Gabby Windey, who's a mixture of Luann from King of the Hill and Elle Woods from Legally Blonde. Windey was put on this earth to be quoted and memed. I'm suggesting these new categories primarily to bring fun back to the Emmys. But let's not forget that reality TV helps power every successful network and streamer. Last November, Comcast announced that it would spin off most of its linear cable networks into a separate company while retaining Bravo. If the Television Academy is concerned about the ratings of its awards show, it should let some of the most passionate fandoms into the tent. To treat a whole sector of programming as less than is to turn your back on relevance at a time when every pair of eyeballs matters. And if you're not convinced that a reality TV performance could be worth honoring, direct your own eyeballs to Bob the Drag Queen's speech at that memorable Traitors Roundtable. It was a wig-snatching Shakespearean tour de force. By the way, reality stars will make for great TV even when they lose, because they won't go quietly into the night. We know this from experience. Donald Trump has whined about losing out on an Emmy for The Apprentice for years and called the show dishonest, a con game, and so boring. The first two criticisms are absurd. The third one's worth thinking about. And now for the June 2025 cover story, A Study in Scarlet. Scarlett Johansson believes in persistence. Diner food, speaking her mind, movies, big and small, redemption, and watch out, Michael Che. Sweet Revenge by David Canfield, with photographs by Lachlan Bailey, styled by Geraldine Salio. Opening photo shows Scarlett Johansson reclining with pillows and blankets around her and three adorable little kittens. Scarlett Johansson, photographed in March in Locust Valley, New York. Whatever kind of diner food you're into is going to be delicious and also enormous. Scarlett Johansson is priming me on what to order at the Ritz Diner, a 60-year-old institution in her Upper East Side neighborhood. She's just walked in wearing bulky circa mural headphones, a plush turquoise turtleneck, and an old Yankees cap, and we're sitting in a small booth by a window with the blinds closed. Today may technically still be in the midst of a dreary New York winter, but this buoyant mid-March afternoon, the temperature inching toward 60 degrees, the sun brightly shining, is signaling the beginning of spring. Before ordering a turkey sandwich on rye, Johansson suggests a change in the season will do us all some good. It's such a weird time. She smiles the kind of nervous smile my mother gives me when she spent too many hours doom-scrolling. For me, there's a blanket of unease, she says. Every day, it feels like you're going to get hit with some news that's disturbing. She asks for a black coffee and a seltzer. I tell her my husband is urging me to disable push alerts on my phone. No, I get it, she says. It's awful. I'm thinking, should I just get rid of my whole news feed now? We trade a few more stories about general political anxiety before Johansson downloads me on her experience at the Oscars from a week prior. She presented alongside June Squibb, the 95-year-old star of Johansson's feature directorial debut, Eleanor the Great, which, it just so happens, includes the Ritz Diner as a key location. They nailed a bit about Squibb actually being the latest disguise of 34-year-old Bill Skarsgård, the hunky shape-shifting star of Nosferatu and It. June was so excited, it made me feel excited too, Johansson says. Otherwise, she has some beef with the Oscars telecast. Why was it so long? I suggest that the elongated tribute to the James Bond franchise might be one possible culprit. No comment, Johansson says. Then comments. It felt like an ad placement. What a weird thing. She didn't watch the whole tribute, but gauged the reaction at an after party. People were like, what the hell was that? Johansson last attended the Oscars 5 years ago, when she was a double nominee for her devastating turns in Marriage Story and Jojo Rabbit. Back then, Hollywood's resistance to Donald Trump remained voluble. Now he's barely acknowledged at public events, including the Academy Awards. I ask what Johansson thinks of this shift, since before Trump's re-election, she'd called the idea of him becoming president again unfathomable. She reminds me of who attended Trump's inauguration in January. These are people that are funding studios. It's all these big tech guys that are funding our industry and funding the Oscars. And so there you go, Johansson says. I guess we're being muzzled in all these different ways, because the truth is that these big tech companies are completely enmeshed in all aspects of our lives. How do you fight that? I don't know how you fight that, she says, pointing to The Apprentice, the lightning rod Trump tale starring Sebastian Stan that most studios refuse to touch. It was acquired by the small distributor Briarcliff Entertainment and received 2 Oscar nominations. Here's where you would go. Okay, you can fight it by making stuff like that, she says. But then what happened with the release? It was buried. As her friends will tell you, Johansson is among the most outspoken A-listers we've got. There's a leadership quality inherent in everything she does, says her fellow Avenger Robert Downey Jr. In 2021, Johansson sued the Walt Disney Company after the studio released Black Widow simultaneously in theaters and on Disney Plus, which was a watershed moment in actors' fight for fair compensation in the streaming era. After reaching a settlement, she got right back into business with the Mouse House, spearheading a Tower of Terror movie, which she is still working on. She's also called out AI companies for appropriating her likeness and allegedly her voice, and is advocating for legislation to curb the technology. She laments to me, however, that she's felt on her own here. There has to be some agreed upon set of boundaries in order for AI to not be detrimental. I wish more people in the public eye would support and speak out about that. I don't know why that's not the case, she says. Johansson keeps close tabs on the Hollywood landscape. She's trying to make hits in the most unpredictable movie-going climate in recent memory and wants to resurrect the kind of 90s big-screen magic that was more prevalent around the beginning of her career and her own adolescence. This is not new. Johansson was only 12 years old when she first realized she wanted to be a director. She had already appeared in a half-dozen films as a kid and was on the precipice of her big break in Robert Redford's sweeping Western tearjerker, The Horse Whisperer. Redford was also directing that movie, and Johansson could sense his vision, his command behind the camera, his sensitivity as a mentor. He would sit me down and take such time talking me through all of the events that led up to the moment in the film and where I was mentally, she says. I'd never experienced anything like that. Her interest only grew from there. She always seemed confident about directing. Since I met her when she was 17, says Sofia Coppola, who directed her in Lost in Translation. But Johansson then helped lead the billion-dollar grossing Marvel Cinematic Universe, at one point becoming Hollywood's highest-paid actress. She is raising a family with her husband, Saturday Night Live's Colin Jost. Directing was never off the table, but a whole lot of life got in the way until now. Johansson was right. The sandwiches are big. More than an hour in, we're chatting with nearly untouched halves on our plates. We talk about the SNL tradition in which her husband and his Weekend Update co-host Michael Che read each other's crudest jokes off a teleprompter without knowing the contents in advance. Che's steadiest target? His colleague's wife. Costco has removed the roast beef sandwich from its menu, Jost nervously began on a December show. But I ain't trippin'. I've been eating roast beef every night since my wife had the kid. Johansson was in the studio watching a monitor. The camera caught her horrified laughter. I had all these cameras on me. I didn't expect the setup to be like that, she says to me now. I was like, wow, you really are seventh, eighth grade boys. She grins out of nowhere. I feel like it's almost my responsibility to come up with some way to burn Michael back. Retaliation, I'd say, should be expected. Others on the show could support this desire. Know what I mean? Her eyes sparkle as though there is a plan in the works. And after our interviews, SNL announces that Johansson will host this year's season finale. If she has exacted revenge by the time you read this, just know that it was months in the making. She gulps down another mug of drip. You just have to be careful how much coffee you drink in a diner, she says. You'll be like bzzz. We pay up front and buzz out of the Ritz. Johansson likes the idea of taking a walk. Got to be careful of the bike lane, she says, and leads me on a brisk march up First Avenue. Born nearby at Lenox Hill Hospital, Johansson was raised in a big family, mostly in Lower Manhattan. At the age of 8, she was already acting in an off-Broadway play starring Ethan Hawke. Her film debut came not long after in 1994 with Rob Reiner's North, and she earned great notices for her lead turn in the 1996 realist indie Manny and Lowe. Coppola highlights that movie as the one that put Johansson on her radar. We're near the tram for Roosevelt Island, which sparks my own flashback, having lived there after college with my parents. The connection between people who've inhabited that strange sliver of land nestled between Queens and Manhattan's east side is uniquely strong. Turns out that Johansson is part of the club. When she was 10, She moved there with her family for a year while they were between apartments. I haven't been there in a long, long time, she says. Remember how the main street had one Chinese restaurant, one pizza place, and one diner? I assure her that, at least as of a decade ago, it still did. Johansson's parents divorced when she was 13 and eventually lived on opposite coast. Her mother jetted from set to set as her chaperone. There was a Coen Brothers movie, The Man Who Wasn't There, a beloved teen cult classic, Ghost World, some duds, Remember My Brother the Pig? Johansson worked regularly while attending professional children's school, a private institution whose student demographic is right there in the name. Making decisions on your own, like adult decisions as a kid, it's a dangerous thing, right? Johansson says. In the last few years, she's read Jeanette McCurdy's memoir, I'm Glad My Mom Died, and watched the doc series Quiet on Set, two harrowing accounts of child stardom gone awry. I lived through that, and also was very fortunate that I dodged a lot of it. One of the last times her mother accompanied her on set was for Lost in Translation. Johansson was 17, living in Tokyo, and profoundly lonely. In the film, she beautifully portrays an alienated recent college graduate who forms a tight bond with a gloomy American movie star played by Bill Murray. Art, in this case, did not imitate life. Johansson was a massive fan of Groundhog Day and What About Bob from childhood, but says of Lost in Translation, Bill was in a hard place. Everybody was on tenterhooks around him, including our director and the full crew, because he was dealing with his stuff. She'd never encountered an actor in that kind of headspace, as she diplomatically puts it, and was left at sea. All eyes were on him. She could only look inward. Earlier this year, Johansson ran into Murray at Saturday Night Live's 50th anniversary special. He interacted warmly with others on set, and she heard stories about him rallying the sketch show's writers with inspiring earnestness. He's such a different person now, she says. I think life has humbled him. I ask if she's referring to the recent allegations of misconduct against him. In 2022, production was suspended on the film Being Mortal after a female crew member reportedly alleged that Murray engaged in inappropriate behavior with her. Murray said at the time, I did something I thought was funny, and it wasn't taken that way. Certainly, yes, that was really bad, Johansson says, but I also know COVID was a hard thing for him. Life, all these things, have led up to him being held accountable for that kind of behavior. She adds later, but you know what? How wonderful that people can change. Johansson still looks back on Lost in Translation with some fondness. I'm pretty proud of how I handled myself. I really just did the work, you know. It's a good tactic for pushing through stuff. She looks off in the distance, then says quietly, eyes on the prize. A brief silence falls. The phrase is an apt motto for Johansson. Even gliding through New York, she's fast and focused. We've been walking uptown on some kind of mission with no end in sight. I don't know where we're going, but she clearly does. Except at one point, she suddenly stops in front of a toy store. It looks a little weird and barren from the outside, and she wonders aloud if it's a drug front before cheerily making her entrance. She starts browsing. I have thoughts, she whispers. No music is playing, and we're the only customers. She is after a specific item, something to occupy my kids in the car. She settles on totally dotty dot to dots, a fairly heavy puzzle and activity book. You never get to go inside a toy store. There aren't many anymore, she says as she walks up to the register. After we exit, she observes, that definitely had a pet store smell. Maybe it's the first day of spring weather, but the city seems to open up once we resume walking. She spots one of her favorite grocery stores. She points out rows of lovely old townhouses. She's flabbergasted by a fruit stand. Look at those bags of cherries. That's like a bajillion cherries, a 5-pound bag. We turn right on 86th Street toward the river. We arrive at Carl Schurz Park, another landmark from Johansson's first feature film, Eleanor the Great. The park overlooks, but of course, Roosevelt Island. Let's go find Eleanor's bench, she says. Well, Eleanor's bench is taken. Every bench is. New Yorkers aren't going to waste a day like this. We snag a spot that's just been vacated, and Johansson slips off her turtleneck. Oh, yes, baby, she yelps toward the East River. We're going to bag some rays. She leans back in her white tank top and closes her eyes. Johansson made Eleanor the Great a hometown gig, shooting all around her Upper Manhattan digs, along with a quick detour to Coney Island, where she spent time with her grandfather as a kid. The film follows Squibb's Eleanor, a retiree who leaves her Florida apartment behind after her roommate and best friend Bessie, Rita Zohar, passes away. She moves in with her daughter, Jessica Hecht, in New York, and starts attending a Holocaust survivors group. The problem? Eleanor is not a survivor. She's appropriating Bessie's story, a convoluted but human act of deception born out of grief, loneliness, and maybe boredom. It's a brilliant showcase for Squibb, who was Oscar-nominated for Alexander Payne's Nebraska and earned acclaim for last year's Thelma. In fact, the whole cast shines. Aaron Kellyman as a student journalist, intrigued by Eleanor. Hecht, who co-starred with Johansson in a 2010 A View from the Bridge Broadway revival. And Zohar, a veteran actor who once starred in Yiddish theater and whose performance is richly affecting. Johansson's deftness as an actor's director is obvious, but pulling off such a polished, appealing crowd pleaser for a budget of next to nothing, that was hardly guaranteed. I was amazed at how open she was, Squibb tells me. There's no playing around. There's absolutely no shit about her at all. Who she is who you're getting all the time. I ask Squibb why she thinks that is. I do think she likes herself. I think Scarlett enjoys being Scarlett, she says. This is positive, because it allows her to say, this is who I am, take it or leave it. I think that's how she goes through life, basically. The script by Tori Kamen came to Johansson through her production company, These Pictures. It felt like the right time to take the plunge. It reminded me very much of those independent films from the 90s, like Living Out Loud, Johansson says. Growing up, she was very close with her Jewish grandmother. I could identify with that part of the story. If I didn't, it would be more challenging, I think, and maybe not totally appropriate for me to direct it. She quickly learned how difficult it is to finance a small character study these days, especially when your star is in her 90s. It fell apart so many times, she says. Independent finance people would go, oh, you want to make this next spring? I was like, no, I don't know if you heard me. The lead actor is 94. She's up to make this now. As we speak, Johansson has submitted the movie to the Cannes Film Festival. She'd dearly love for it to premiere there, and she's anxious since she hasn't heard back. What's taking so long? What's going on? It will ultimately be accepted by Cannes. Sony Pictures Classics is expected to release Eleanor in the fall, with another prominent backer being Wayfarer Studios, the production company founded by Justin Baldoni. Johansson never met Baldoni because he was busy making It Ends With Us, the source of his explosive legal battle with Blake Lively, who's accused Baldoni of sexual harassment. He denies the allegations and is suing Lively for defamation, among other claims. When I bring up Baldoni, Johansson lets out a loud, knowing laugh. That's the standard reaction these days, given how public the feud has become. They were super supportive throughout the process, she says of Wayfarer, but yeah, such weird timing. While she was shooting Eleanor, Johansson locked in another huge opportunity, the lead of the upcoming movie Jurassic World Rebirth. She went to make that tent pole across the globe right after filming on Eleanor finished. How different does she think the movie's budgets were? I'd say Eleanor was like 300 times less. Her smirk implies a smidge of hyperbole, but this is someone who's long understood how to balance the multiplex with the art house. After wrapping an exhausting day on Rebirth, she'd shift into Eleanor post-production mode. I was far away, so the time difference worked out where I could then go straight into editing, which is wonderful, she says. Eleanor came in tight, well under 2 hours. Movies are so long now. They're too long, don't you think so? She says. It feels like a chore. She's very pleased that Wes Anderson cut his latest movie, The Phoenician Scheme, in which Johansson plays a small but memorable role, down to 1 hour and 41 minutes. Johansson stands at the park's railing to fully take in the view. Isn't it heaven? She asks. God, I haven't felt sun on my skin for so long. She's loosened up in the few hours we've been together. When I ask her how she feels about interviews these days, she answers quickly. I'm always kind of wary because they're so subjective. There have been times when journalists wrote up seemingly genuine conversations in ways that surprised her and felt unfair. I love to talk, and I love to listen and share stories and commiserate and open up. I'm a pretty open book, I think, she says later. Then she seems to catch herself. I mean, of course I'm guarded in some ways, like we all have to be. When she was in her teens and early 20s, Johansson was consistently and blatantly objectified by male and female journalists alike. The person would be like describing my body, and you wouldn't expect that to be what the takeaway was, she says. They were staring at my lips that whole time? That's so rude. She brings up a recent Instagram video posted by Millie Bobby Brown, calling out journalists by name who'd written disparagingly about her appearance. She's 21 years old. And these are visible writers, Johansson says. I guess they still do that. I don't think that people can do that. This dynamic fed into a period of professional dissatisfaction for Johansson, in part why she considered directing so strongly. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.